First of all, I want to take this opportunity to thank Rabbi Yellen and his Rebbetzin for beautiful Hachnosas Orchim, and Rabbi Yellen for putting this all together. Looks like it was somewhat of a family effort. We appreciate that too. And really, very, very special privilege to be here, and we're eternally grateful for all of your efforts, and hopefully it will leave a roshim. Once again, I find myself in a difficult position. My intention was to talk here this morning about some rational ideas, some emotional touches, but that we could use to strengthen ourselves, certainly to strengthen our children, if it's Talmidim, the community at large. I must say that Rabbi Light's presentation has simplified the process so much that on the one hand, I wonder, maybe this discussion is superfluous. Besides the fact that it's hard to sit down once you get the mic, but let's leave that aside. But I think that there's still room for some serious discussion about the issues, the thoughts, the doubts, the problems that our children have. Because on the one hand, even though what they are and who they are religiously, and their sense and image and concept of HaKadosh Baruch Hu will emanate from their parents, sometimes parents also need chizuk. Sometimes parents also need to strengthen themselves. And oftentimes, besides that, there are questions. And despite the fact that they have this deep sense of appreciation of a creator, of a parent, a loving parent, that their parents have modeled for them, they do see some contradictions sometimes in the world out there. Sometimes they don't always get the message even directly or clearly from their parents. And I believe, therefore, that there's still a need to discuss in a very general sense some of these issues and see how we could strengthen ourselves and therefore be able to strengthen our children as well. I would like to mention, and that's what this is all about, that one of the issues today is that it's very hard to get people to listen. Lectures, not very in vogue. Concentration span, how much is it? Between 45 seconds and 3 minutes, maybe a little bit more. So it's really a very difficult thing. And therefore, we conceive the idea of very short video presentations, which can give a burst of chizuk and be very helpful in developing some of these concepts to give strength, to give a greater sense of the reality of Torah Sinai, because it all depends upon what happened at Har Sinai. Har Sinai is 3,300 plus years behind us, and sometimes it's a little bit confusing to figure out what really took place. And whatever we can do to try to strengthen this awareness can be helpful, and certainly work together to help the love that we put into our children and the example that we set for them in terms of developing a concept of Hashem can flesh it out a little more and can maybe deal with some of the issues and some of the questions that we have. So that's what I would like to do today for a few moments. I'd like to tell you a little story that happened many years ago. Living in Los Angeles at the time, and there was a neighbor across the street, two children, not a religious family at all by any means, but the children were enrolled in the local day school. And we invited the family for a Seder. Two children, one must have been The girl must have been about 11 and the boy about 8 or 9. Tricia and Chad, I still remember their names even though it was many, many years ago. And at the Seder, I don't know why, but I asked the following question. Why did we have to go out of Mitzrayim so quickly? B'chipozon, why was it that the Jewish people had to leave Mitzrayim so quickly? And surprisingly, Chad knew the answer. He said, because we have to eat matzah on Pesach. His father was a little bit disturbed by this answer. I don't know what he knew, but maybe he read it on the Manischewitz matzah box that we eat matzah on Pesach because we went out quickly from Mitzrayim. But it doesn't say any place that we went out quickly from Mitzrayim because we have to eat matzah on Pesach. Chad had it backwards. And in reality, he didn't. And to save the day and to help the father, and he shouldn't be upset at all the wasted tuition that he must have been thinking at the time. I said, you know, there was a great Jew, Bershaber Soloveitchik, with Beis Halevi, who wrote that, yes, exactly what Chad said is true. He says that the Torah preceded creation. And the Torah is the blueprint of creation. And if, in fact, there's a mitzvah of eating matzah on Pesach, then we had to go out speedily. The history developed according to the blueprint. And since one of the mitzvahs in the Torah is the eat matzah zeicher lechipozayim, then history had to unfold according to the directives, according to the plan, according to the outline of the Torah. This is something that's sometimes a little bit difficult for people to appreciate, but it's the ultimate reality. And when we find in our Torah so much information that is would have been impossible for any human being to know at the time, and the information that only either took place or only was or discovered or became reality, so to speak, later on, years long, hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years later, that gives us a great sense of the Amitius HaTorah. The Gemara in Chulin says that in the discussion around Daf Samach, I think, discussion of all the simonim of the behemoths that Moshe Rabbeinu knew, the amazing biological and anatomy that Moshe Rabbeinu was aware of. And so the Gemara asks the question, Otu Moshe Rabbeinu kenigi hoyo or blistery hoyo? Was Moshe Rabbeinu, I don't know what it means, a zoologist or a hunter? How did Moshe Rabbeinu know all this information that no human being could have known? And the Gemara answers, Mikan tshuva le'oimer ein Torah min hashamayim. This provides an answer to anyone who would dare say that Torah is not from Hashem, that Torah is not min hashamayim. And it's very interesting to note, the Gemara does not say this is how we know Torah is min hashamayim. We know Torah min hashamayim because we have edus of millions of eyewitnesses who heard Aku saw the miracles of Mitzrayim, who heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu speak at Har Sinai, who heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu publicly appoint Moshe Rabbeinu as his teacher, as his Novi, and authorized him to pass the Torah on and everything he teaches to future generations. And we know that that document was recorded, and it was passed down accurately, meticulously from one generation to the next. And today, thousands of years later, we all read from the same Sifrei Torah with virtually no discrepancies. And this is the power of Mesorah. The Eidus is alive and well. The testimony of that generation, not only do we read again and again publicly and finish every single year in every city, in every state, in every country, throughout the world, wherever Jews find themselves. But it goes much further than that. We live a life that testifies to the truth of this Torah. We put on the same tefillin, and we wear the same tzitzis, and we sit in the same sukkah, and we take the same lulav, and we eat the same matzah, v'chule, 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 for thousands of years. And even though we've been separated from some parts of the Klal Yisrael for maybe over 1,000 years, we come back together, and we discover that we're all on the same page, that we have not changed the text in the slightest, And even though we have different minhogim, we may differ in certain things, and even though there may be some cultural differences based on the host nation, but basically we are the living testimony to the truth of Maimon Har Sinai. The Torah Har Sinai, Nevuas Moshe Rabbeinu, is alive and well to this very day. And all of us sitting here, and all of the Klal Yisroel that practices Torah and Mitzvahs, are testifying to the truth of Torah Misinai. So what is the Gemara talking about? The Gemara says, Tshuva lo oimer in Torah min Hashemayim. If someone might have a doubt, all of a sudden, you know, we're all human, and there are all types of outside influences, and sometimes there's confusion, and sometimes when there's distress, and sometimes when life gets a little bit tough, and we become a little bit disillusioned, and we suffer certain tragedies, or we have certain seemingly insurmountable issues, and we start to shake, and we start to think. So Chazal tell us, there's also, to those who might still have questions after the Eidus that we have from our Sinai, there's a tshuva she'ent lemisha oimer ain't terem in Hashemayim. And that's what we'd like to discuss a little bit this morning. So what we did is we put on short videos some of the basic concepts which we will find. Two of the general categories are, one, nevuah in the Torah. It's interesting that if one reads the Torah, one thinks that this is a historical document. It's recording history, because all of these events took place from Har Sinai, from the life in the Midbar, from going into Eretz Yisrael, from being exiled from Eretz Yisrael, from living in the Golos to this very day, and this is a history book. The problem is that the history book was written thousands of years ago, before the history unfolded. And that creates this sense that Torah min Hashemayim, to anyone who would question, to anyone who would doubt. And we believe that it's very important that our children have this sense. And what could be a more current, relevant presentation than video presentations? Because that's what they're into, and maybe they have the patience to listen to them. I must tell you that these videos have been shown in Chadorim and in Lakewood and other places, and the response is very, very positive. But I want to make an apology and a point. The narrator is not Jewish, and you can tell that from his presentation. Truth be told, it was much cheaper than the others. And it made the project more feasible. I mean, extremely cheaper. However, after being a little bit embarrassed at his pronunciation and his Anglicization of our holy words, I realized that it has a very, very important benefit. You know, one of the problems that we have, and I must admit that the more that our children, and the more that we have a positive image of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this problem is much less. But it exists. And that problem is resistance. Resistance. When someone tells us that they are going to prove something to us, our first gut reaction is, no, you're not. I'm not sure whether that's a Jewish thing or whether that's a human thing. It's certainly a Jewish thing. You know, we are argumentative. We don't take proofs from anyone easily. We're constantly looking at the other side. And sometimes that becomes very threatening. And to reduce what we call the defense mechanisms is extremely important. When we speak too strongly, when we speak too authoritatively, when we speak too forcefully, there's a certain resistance. When we speak softly, when we speak nicely, when we appear that we have no agenda, when we have a goy teaching us these ideas, it's a whole different story. So b'di'evid, the fiscal benefits, or the, I would say, the psychological benefits even outweigh the monetary benefits, and therefore. So I would like to present you, it's a long program, we're not going to show all of them. I would say that anyone who's interested, number one, these all appear on the Priority One website, that's priority-1.org. They are available also in the USB form, which you can get by calling our office. There's even a new form that they're coming out with. I'm not even sure what it is, but it'll be available. And it's something that we feel, we hope, can be a source of chizuk. So I'd like to show you a few now, because we certainly don't have time for all of them. And then at the end, when we finish, we have what I believe is a very special closing to this program. Two very distinguished young men, yeshiva bochrim, who have years of experience learning and great accomplishments in their learning, a wide range of experience, to discuss some of the issues that exist today, some of the problems and challenges we have, and maybe some suggestions, hearing it from those literally out in the field, those that are on the other side of the desk, and to see maybe we can pick up some insights that could be very helpful. So that's what we hope to share with you. Okay, let us begin. Do you have numbers there?
Yeah.
Do you have the first one?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start there. This scientific information is a very beneficial thing today because we're into science. Society has told us that science is king. I would dare not say what society really calls science. You know, they think science is Kaviyochel himself. And when we see the accuracy and the detail of scientific information that we find in Chazal, it's something that's very impressive. And again, understated. You know, well, don't make a big issue out of it because then there's resistance. But let's just watch the video. I don't know, we'll see.
There are few things as dangerous as a stormy sea. Modern ships, built with reinforced steel plates, often break apart in storms from the force of the water hitting their hull. One can only imagine how dangerous seafaring was in antiquity. To survive the danger of the seas, humankind has spent millennia refining our shipbuilding skills, using trial and experiment to conceive of the most buoyant and stable designs. For most of our recorded history, ships were just too fragile to survive the open ocean and were restricted to local bodies of water. Only approximately 1,000 years ago had nautical technology advanced enough to allow the famed Viking longship to traverse the Mediterranean. In the Bible, we find God commanding Noah to build a uniquely shaped vessel to withstand the coming deluge that would cover the world. The length of the ark was to be 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. Our sages noted these dimensions and extrapolated from them the ideal proportions for a naval vessel. Our sages have a tradition that the Bible is teaching us the way of the world. Should a man desire to build a boat that can withstand the ocean, he should construct the ship's width to be 1/6 of its length and its height to be 1/10 of its length. As it turns out, these dimensions, 30 to 5 to 3, are the perfect ratio for building large vessels. In 1843, British engineer Isambard Kingdom Brunel made the Great Britain, a steamship with almost identical proportions to the Ark, and it was considered one of the most magnificent displays of maritime engineering of its day. The tenacity of these dimensions to withstand the violent and unpredictable forces of the ocean were confirmed in 1904 in Denmark, where a 30-foot-long vessel was made in the exact proportions of the Ark. According to the Copenhagen newspaper, Dagbladet, the remarkable thing about the Bible measurements is that after thousands of years' experience in the art of shipbuilding, they must be confessed to be still the ideal proportions for the construction of a big ship. In a storm, the motion of the ark would be reduced to a minimum. If the greatest living engineer in the world was given such a commission as this, to construct as large and strong a vessel as to lie still upon the sea, and as simply constructed as the ark, he could not make a better vessel. These findings have been confirmed by Korean naval engineers, who published a study on the ark's structural integrity in the April 1994 Journal of Creation. According to the study, which analyzed the structural safety, overturning stability, and seakeeping quality of a boat with the ark's dimensions, the authors found that, quote, the ark had a superior level of safety in high winds and waves compared with the other hull forms studied. The voyage limit of the ark, estimated on the basis of modern passenger ships' criteria, revealed that it could have navigated through waves higher than 30 meters, end quote. It is astonishing to think that after thousands of years of refining our shipbuilding abilities, we are only beginning to appreciate the wisdom that our sages saw in the Bible.
The night sky glimmers with stars, but how many stars are there in the universe? Without the aid of telescopes, only 6,000 stars are visible to the naked eye.
One of the hallmarks of Jewish law is its extreme sensitivity to the pain of others. Our mandate to minimize suffering extends even to animals, and we are forbidden from causing any creature unnecessary pain. This idea is evidenced in the Jewish laws regarding the kosher slaughter of animals for food. Every year, over 60 billion chickens and over 4 billion farm animals are killed worldwide to satisfy humanity's need for protein. Methods of slaughter vary around the world, from asphyxiation with nitrogen gas to stunning with a captive bolt pistol and the cutting of the chest by the heart. Jewish law commands that an animal's throat be slit with a sharp knife in one quick movement. For many years, various governmental bodies around the world have tried to outlaw or ban Jewish slaughter with the claim that it caused animals to suffer needlessly. A closer look at animal physiology reveals not only the humane nature of kosher slaughter, but the astonishing divine wisdom encoded in Jewish law. All mammals have two main arteries carrying blood back and forth from the brain, the carotid artery in the front of the neck, and the vertebral artery located in the back of the neck. When an animal's neck is slit with a knife, the carotid artery is severed, but the vertebral artery remains intact. This means that blood will continue flowing towards the animal's brain, keeping it conscious and in pain for a long time until it bleeds out. This is inhumane and an unacceptable way to process animals for food. Remarkably, out of the entire animal kingdom, kosher animals, and only kosher animals, possess a unique physiological trait. The circulatory system of kosher animals are designed in such a way that both the carotid artery and the vertebral arteries are located at the front of the neck. During kosher slaughtering, both veins are cut, immediately removing all blood supply from the animal's brain. This induces unconsciousness and leads to a singularly painless and humane death. How could human farmers living thousands of years ago have possibly known that? Of all the animals on the entire planet, only kosher animals have this unique physiological makeup. Such an unparalleled knowledge of our world points to a master planner and creator as the source of our laws. Fish exist in an astonishing army of diversity. From killer sharks to strange glowing monstrosities, few things fill us with wonder like the sheer incredibleness of our ocean's inhabitants. According to modern science, there are currently approximately 33,600 recognized species of fish. This number is constantly changing, as hundreds of new species are discovered each year. The truth is that the oceans are so vast and deep that despite all our research, most of the marine world lies shrouded in mystery. It would be complete hubris for a human being to make a broad generalization about all marine life. Yet over 2,000 years ago, our sages revealed a remarkable fact. All fish that have scales also have fins. This incredible claim about the nature of all marine life is especially remarkable when considering that in the ancient Near East fishermen were bound by crude fishing implements, mostly basic nets, spears, and hooks, and they were only exposed to a small number of fish species living in their area. People certainly knew nothing of the thousands of freshwater fish in African rivers, or the strange and translucent fish of the deep ocean. Yet still, our sages were confident enough to say that any fish with scales must have fins. Since this statement was written thousands of years ago, ichthyologists have not found a single species of fish that possesses scales without fins. Not one. Of one of the estimated 3.5 trillion fish swimming in the sea, we have not encountered a single fish that has scales but no fins. Our sages could have only made such a statement if they had access to divine knowledge. One of the Jewish people's most sacred rites.
The story of the Jews is one of the most astonishing and improbable tales ever told. The survival of the Jews from ancient times until today defies all historical precedent. When our nation was young, we were a small kingdom with vastly different values and beliefs than our surrounding neighbors. In a world that believed in a wild and corrupt pantheon of God, each nation clinging to their patron deity, the Jews were the first to introduce the concept of the one supreme God of all creation. This idea was so revolutionary. God was not a corporal vindictive tyrant. Instead, he is the benevolent, omnipresent source of all reality who had created this world to bestow goodness onto humanity. With this truth, the Jews brought a moral code of law that is without parallel in any other civilization in history. We were different and outcast to the rest of the world, yet we still clung to our faith. Then, with the destruction of the temple, we were sent into exile. Every other nation in history that has lost their homeland has eventually disappeared, their remnant only visible inside the forgotten books of history. But the Jews persevered despite the exile. We survived the Babylonian exile, where the king Nebuchadnezzar tried to force us to bow to his idols. We survived the genocidal attempts of the Amalekites to wipe us from the face of the earth during the Persian exile. We survived when, 2,000 years ago, the Romans carted all our men off to be sold as slaves or killed for sport in the gladiator ring. Not only did we survive, we flourished. After the Romans razed the Second Temple to the ground, the Jews spread across the world, establishing communities in Europe, China, and the Arabian Peninsula. We flourished wherever we landed, yet we never assimilated. We remained distinct, and despite intense persecution, never compromised our divine mandate. Our unique role angered those around us, and the Jews had to endure punishing crusades, inquisitions, and discrimination by Christians and Muslims alike. Throughout history, Jews had been barred from most businesses, forbidden from owning land, and subject to oppressive taxation. In Europe, this simmering cauldron of anti-Semitism eventually bubbled over into the darkest period of human history, the Holocaust. From 1939 to 1945, Jews across Europe were hunted, tortured, and killed by the millions. All while the world watched silently. Families tried to flee, but the world closed its borders, condemning millions of Jews to die at the hands of the Nazis. But against all the odds, the Jewish nation survived. We rebuilt our homeland and established strong communities around the world. whether it's a Yemenite Jew who survived 40 generations of mistreatment by his neighbors, or a Polish Jew whose ancestors died rather than kissing the cross. We survived. There is no natural explanation for the survival of the Jews. It is a singular event in history and defies all attempts at naturalistic explanations. There is only one reasonable explanation. God promised Abraham that he would establish an eternal covenant with his descendants. All the events in Jewish history are foretold in the Bible and the prophets, from our exile to our eventual return to our homeland and the ultimate redemption. Our very survival is the most enduring testament to the unique nature of the Jewish people.
16. Truth is elusive and precious. Over the millennia, many religions have risen up claiming to be the guardians of ultimate truth. But when one turns back the clock and explores the origins of the world's religions, a startling fact emerges. Experience tells us that it is foolish to trust the testimony of a single man claiming to have experienced a private revelation. Over the ages, millions of people have been duped by charlatans claiming to possess the secrets of reality. But how did the world's religions begin? They all began with a single man claiming access to a higher dimension. Islam has 1.6 billion followers. Yet Islam began with a single illiterate man claiming to have ascended to heaven and experienced a divine revelation. Christianity has an astonishing 2.2 billion adherents, but it also is founded on the testimony of a tiny number of people. Buddhism, too, began with a single man who claimed to have found the truth. No religion claims that God revealed himself to an entire nation except Judaism. How is it possible that of the thousands of religions that ever existed, not a single one claims that God publicly revealed himself? The answer is that while the human mind is capable of being fooled, a lie of such proportions is impossible to fabricate. It is simply impossible to fool an entire nation into believing that they experienced a divine encounter. The Bible tells us that God appeared at Mount Sinai in front of the entire Jewish nation. Over 2 million people witnessed Moses speaking directly with God. Those millions of people passed on the story of their remarkable encounter with their children. Those children grew old and passed on the tradition to their children. And those children passed on the story to their children until today. This ironclad chain of transmission has continued uninterrupted for 3,300 years. You are the next link in this chain. This is the remarkable heritage of every Jew.
As you noticed, there were many more varied topics, all the same type of opportunity for chizuk, and we encourage everyone to take advantage. They are on the Priority One website available. They could also be, if you contact the Priority One office, you can get USB or another format. But the idea, I think, is very, very significant. We don't want to speak in two powerful, dramatic terms, or I should say rather, insistent terms, when we wish to make sure that our children, or even ourselves, have a clear picture of what life is all about and what truth is all about. But it's done in a way that seems less threatening, such as this medium or a conversation, a casual conversation that we have. The message, which is really very, very powerful, being understated, has a much better chance of reaching its goal.